And I'll have to go ahead and get started. First up this afternoon, we have competing special events permit. Councilmember Bilderback has an update for us, so let's go ahead.
It is no longer a conflict. With discussing or having numerous conversations this last week with City Clerk's Office, Public Works, City Attorney's Office, and Administration, and with the participants this morning. And it's already happened that the Tap House has decided to move their event to a different day. So there is no conflict, and tonight I will offer a resolution to make sure we don't run into this issue again. So that is taken care of.
All right. Any questions from council members or the city attorney? Or we'll take up the resolution this evening, which should help clarify future occurrences, prevent that from happening. Mr. Campion.
Councilmember Bilderback, you worked on this personally.
Yes.
I would like to thank you personally for resolving it before it came to a meeting. We had a short discussion ahead of time that was, we have a lot of very, very important business to deal with at the city council, and it's great when we can get some of these issues worked out on an amicable basis before they come for the council. So I'm happy to hear that we have that and appreciate your extra effort to make sure that resolution was found.
Definitely. What it means.
Well, he was a lot more successful than I was, so I surely thank you for getting that resolved. Jeez.
It's been an interesting
time, I would imagine. Mr. Russell.
I just like to thank Mark too. I know I put a lot of time into this. These are things that should never happen, and with that, I'd also like to recognize the owners of the Tap House for taking the high road on this. I think they really handled themselves properly and made a positive reflection on a negative situation. So,
all right. Anything else? As I say, we'll take up the resolution this evening. So, without further ado, we'll move on to our second item, which is Emerald Ash Borer presentation. Mr. Nigber, or anyone want to cue this up for us? Or
I think we'll just start off with Jeff starting off and introducing who he's got for guests here, and can start talking the presentation. Jeff?
Yes, sir. Oh, Mike? Mr. President, yes. The mayor just gave this to me to hand out to the council. It's something that he gathered at a mayor's committee. It's on the Emerald Ash thing.
Okay, let me first introduce myself. I'm Jeff Hauberman, and I want to thank the council members and the committee as a whole for allowing us to come and speak on this subject. I have help in presenting this information. Two members from Rainbow Tree Care, Jeff Affner and Michael Orange, are joining us, and they will help present this information. So, we're here to talk about the EAB infestation that is in Rochester and bring light in terms of the management plan that we've developed and put some numbers in front of you in terms of the budget and what we might expect it will cost the city to deal with the problem. So, first of all, I just wanted to show you the extent of emerald ash borer infested areas in the United States. And originally it started in Michigan, was the epicenter, and it sort of spread out in all directions from there, in some cases faster than we expected that it would move, in other cases maybe not so fast, but the point is it's becoming a very widespread epidemic problem. And it was discovered here in Rochester in August of 2014. The first infestation was found between Rochester and Stuartville and the I-90 corridor at the intersection of Highway 63. And a week later, it was discovered just outside of the city limits on Windsor Lane Southwest. That particular infestation was on private property, and the homeowners had suspected they had it for a number of years. They were losing ash trees, and they had companies coming to do the removal work and, you know, ask them on more than one occasion if it was EAB, and were told, no, don't worry about it, it's not here. And so finally, when they had heard about the first find, they decided to contact the Minnesota Department of Ag directly, and that's how this one, the second find, came to light. Now, that one happened to be right across 40th Street from the city limits, and so we actually got in contact with the Minnesota Department of Ag and the Minnesota DNR right away. and found that we were qualified for grant money to help begin dealing with the problem. So I want to talk about some of the preemptive work that was done prior to the infestation showing up. And we had the forestry department had a policy in place whereby if people wanted to remove the ash tree on their boulevard, that we would do that work for them and replace it at no cost to them, which is an advantage. That's not typically how it works. And this was carried out as long as we had money and funding from the DNR to complete that work. There was no actual management plan for EAB at this time, prior to its confirmation here. And they were successful in removing, and I say they because I showed up here in May of 2005, and prior to that, they had removed about 2,000 boulevard trees and replaced them. And then, of course, I should note that RPU manages their own ash population in the right-of-way of the utilities in town. So after its discovery in August, I'm just going to kind of describe the activities that occurred in the department with respect to EAB. And the first thing that we needed to do was to update our ash inventory to find out the exact number that we had to get accurate measurements of the size. And then, of course, we were interested in not only size, but the condition of the tree and if there were any conflicts, either above ground or below ground, actually. And so we made that assessment, and that took about 6 or 7 months to complete, looking at all 5,800 trees that we have. That's very important information to have moving forward in determining how we're going to deal with it from here on. So we asked the MDA to come down and train our staff, and which they did. And this is essentially what you're looking for. The earliest way to detect an infestation in a tree is by finding woodpecker holes. And from there, because woodpeckers are fond of emerald ash borer larvae, it's a very good meal, and they seem to really be active in pursuing it. So once you get multiple pecks in a small area like this, the wood underneath dries and it kind of coalesces into a split, which is on the left side. And within those splits now, with a good set of binoculars, we can identify the galleries, and this can be confirmed if these trees have it or not. And the infestations always start in the upper canopy of the tree and work their way down. So last winter, the winter of 2014 and 15, we actually found 3 confirmed trees, and this is citywide. They were all in the southwest quadrant, and in fact, they were all within a mile of that initial find. And we found 5 more trees that we suspected might have it, but we could not confirm the galleries. Then in addition to that, last summer we helped coordinate an EAB pesticide training with the help of Rainbow Tree Care and just offered, to municipalities in the area and any private industry people that were interested to come and take a look at how you can use chemicals to combat this problem. As I mentioned, we received funding from the DNR, so this kind of outlines the 1 mile buffer that we could create around the infestation. And so we proceeded to look at every single tree within that buffer and, specifically ash trees. We weren't looking at anything else. And then in that process, we decided that we would remove 52 ash trees. And with DNR funding, we were able to remove, grind the stumps, and put good-sized replacement trees in for those 52 locations in order to get, to get more diversification established in that area. Some of the other decisions that we based the removals on, if there were other trees that were providing canopy and we felt that we could remove one without causing significant issues in the canopy cover, we did it. In some cases, there were private trees competing with public trees. Those got removed. And in other cases, the spacing was so narrow that it just made sense to remove. So in addition to those that were confirmed and suspected, then we also removed additional ash trees, as I outlined. So then in the second year, the activities, so basically from mid-2015 to present, we had completed our inventory work. So we realized that we needed to come up with a management plan, and that's the basis for this discussion today. So we contracted Rainbow Tree Care. They have a lot of experience developing plans for municipalities, and it has been a wonderful experience to deal with them and tap into that knowledge. Of course, we continued our monitoring activities. So this, about a week ago, is when we actually started our monitoring and detection for this year. And this year we decided that we needed to focus a little bit more on private trees, because that's really a big unknown with this issue. First of all, how many private ash trees exist, for one, because there's no inventory information. And last year we concentrated solely on public trees. So we began our inspections a week ago, and we have already confirmed 14 additional trees that we could not see signs in last winter. Some of these trees were followed up on over the summer. We still could not. But now with this winter and the woodpecker activity, they're basically showing up as, you know, full-blown infested trees. And it turns out that 10 of those that we've found so far, and we're still working in the southwest quadrant, but 10 of those have been on private property and 4 additional on public property.
Question, Jeff.
I have a question.
Jeff, you're on a roll and you're doing a great job. Is there any chance you could talk sitting down? Because, yeah, I can't see that.
Yeah, I prefer it.
I'm sitting there trying to look around and I'm missing half of these statistics.
Sorry, it's a win-win.
Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt.
It only gets better. So.
Thank you.
And, of course, we haven't completely used up the money. We received $40,000 of grant money from the DNR, and I think we spent about $28,000 last year on the work that we did on the removals. So this year we'll continue to finish using that money, which will target the trees that we're finding this year, and then move outward from there until that money is used up. And, of course, we hope to begin the implementation of this EAB management plan that we're going to discuss here this evening. And I'm going to let Jeff Hafner from Rainbow Tree Care now.
Where should I
sit down?
Just we'll trade seats.
There you go.
We'll keep the first names consistent, regardless of who is sitting in the chair. I'm happy to be here talking about trees with everyone. And I agree with Jeff. It has been a real pleasure to support city staff in this very important project. My background is a municipal consulting arborist. This is what I do every day, help cities figure out how to manage their public trees, largely focused on the invasive species, because they're the biggest threat, and they're causing the most damage. I'd like to frame the discussion around trees as important components of our infrastructure, because they provide benefits very similar to numerous components of our gray infrastructure systems. I think helping people see trees as infrastructure allows them easier understanding of why it's important to preserve what we have rather than remove and replace, because any other component in the gray infrastructure system, when you talk about just wholesale removal and replacement, the costs are typically far higher than just applying some money toward preservation efforts. So I'll try to keep that kind of in the background of the conversation. Some of the benefits that I alluded to as far as trees as infrastructure, we can now quantify the dollar value that trees provide in numerous parts of our city and our infrastructure systems. As far as the reduction of stormwater runoff, trees help capture rainwater and convert it to groundwater, eliminating the need for managing the surface runoff. We know they save energy through shading, they store carbon from the atmosphere, they filter particulate matter out of our air, leading to improved human health. Now, all of this is quantifiable on any scale, from the neighborhood to the city to the state to the nation. These have been documented in peer review. Crime, noise, all come down. Property values go up. And the best part, I think the easiest part, is that they are popular with the people. So if you think of a mechanical air quality improvement system not being such a popular sale, whereas as trees are easy to put in neighborhoods and have them apply these benefits. Here's a breakout. This is from the National Tree Benefits Calculator. Again, a peer-reviewed tool that allow homeowners, municipalities, really anyone who's an advocate of trees, to plug in the size of their tree and see a breakout of those benefits by component. So 18 inches is a good average-sized ash tree. So on a boulevard, a healthy ash tree is going to provide about $165 in benefits per year. So every year, just doing what it's doing, those benefits are being provided to the municipality. And you can make the case that those benefits are being provided even on the private side of that property line. But we're looking at just the city trees, and you can see the breakout there. Stormwater is a big one, property value another big component. All the other ones there shown in individual dollars per individual tree. EAB is a big problem because the rate at which trees die. This is kind of a, you know, a marketing mock-up, but it's not incorrect in the fact that we're looking at the death of millions of trees. Minnesota is the leading state as far as ash tree populations. We have close to 1 billion trees in the state. So hundreds of millions of trees are going to die in the next 10 to 15 years because of this pest. Largely because it's an invasive pest with no natural predators here. So with an unlimited food source, it can exponentially grow in numbers, and trees start to die faster and faster as those populations get really big. This is more of the scientific look at it. Back in 2004, researchers in Ohio started measuring the rate at which trees were dying in a particular unmanaged watershed where EAB had taken hold. Now, they dug back into the growth rings of those trees to see the rate at which they died in the 10 years that preceded that. But that solid line, those are direct measurements of the rate at which trees died. So we call this the EAB death curve, and this is what all of our management plans look to address, that steep increase at the rate of which trees die. That causes a spike in costs and headaches as far as staff time and management. We're working to keep that line as flat as we can. This is what the death curve looks like on the street. This is Toledo, Ohio. All of those benefits that I alluded to before are gone in this case. Many homeowners who moved to this neighborhood because of the tree-lined street, the closed canopy, that all disappears in a relative short amount of time. And you can see that the difficulty in getting dead trees down quickly is difficult to achieve. So many municipalities that don't take action, in this case didn't have the tools in which to take action, were left with this to deal with. Numerous public safety concerns that also arise out of this. Ash trees are brittle, even in their best condition. When EAB kills them, they become extremely brittle and start to fall apart within that season of death, typically. So it starts to be a real public nuisance and a public safety concern. Here is a photo from Bloomington, Illinois. This is the local newspaper there talking about that very concept. Not able to get their dead trees down, looming over pedestrians as they walk on the street. One, you know, component of this discussion is that as states like ours are more informed about the impacts of EAB, we will be less likely to claim, you know, that we didn't know. We didn't know it was coming. We have a lot of information that we've gained from the states to the east. We are also offered the luxury of many more management tools to help us deal with it. One of those tools is a study that was done a few years ago. It's called SLAM. We refer to it as SLAM, the acronym, really to slow ash mortality. What they did was they built a city in a computer model. They filled it full of ash trees, and they applied numerous management strategies to those trees and then predicted the rate at which they died. What they found was that by having a certain percentage of those trees treated with insecticide, they were able to flatten that death curve and buy everybody more time, largely because as the adults emerge from the infested trees, they fly to nearby trees to feed on the leaves. If any of those nearby trees are treated, the insects die and the life cycle is interrupted, so you don't see that exponential kind of growth rate of the pest. Now, what's important to keep in mind is that not every tree has to be treated. There is just a percentage of trees that's important to have treated to help flatten that death curve. So this study looked to really slow the onset and progression of widespread ash mortality in an EAB outlier site. The city of Rochester is an EAB outlier site right now because it's not the result of an advancing wave of an infestation from a neighboring city. It's an infestation that was found to be on its own. So this model and its strategies are very appropriate to what you're dealing with here because we look to slow the onset and the progression of that infestation. Through that, we reduce the rate at which the populations of the pest grow, which then decreases the rate at which trees die. What we do know without a doubt is that previous management strategies that only looked to remove the trees failed. You cannot possibly eliminate enough of the food source to have any effect on the pest population. They just fly over that removed tree to the next one. Initial efforts looked at a mile of just sheer ash removal, and it did absolutely nothing. And we never know where that leading edge of the infestation is, because the damage shows up after the infestation has been there. So that's a difficult strategy to try to implement with any success. What we also know, without a doubt, is that multiple tools are required for this strategy to be successful.
We have a quick question here.
Yeah, I just had a question on this SLAM study. So the initial study was a computer simulation. Has it been corroborated in real world cases or
it is strategy? Yeah, but there are numerous researchers looking at it on different scales currently. The difficulty is that it takes so long to get real world results.
Sure.
But anecdotally, all of the researchers involved have been surprised by what they're seeing. Even when, so like one case study, for instance, Midland, Michigan is a little city. Their city council elected to protect their high quality ash trees on their boulevards. It's not a huge percentage of the total. At the same time, the university was trying to conduct a trial on ash treatments nearby, not right next to it, but within the city limits. 5 years into that study, they were unable to get the untreated controlled trees to die at all, completely flying in the face of what the death curve had shown everywhere else in the country, just because there were enough treated trees in that public tree population to help suppress that level. So again, anecdotally,
sure.
The University of Minnesota has a trial site in Minneapolis. All of the surrounding trees have been killed and removed. They still have untreated trees in their study group that aren't keeping pace with the rest of the trees as well. So,
thank you.
Yes.
You also mentioned that you don't have to necessarily treat the entire population, a percentage of the population. What percentage do you have to treat to achieve some positive effect?
In that model, it predicted 20% treated randomly every year was enough to basically eliminate the death curve. But there's a couple big caveats in that. They immediately began treating those 20% randomly the day they found EAB in that model. So the pest population never had a chance to develop much at all. So we use that as kind of a guideline. And certainly later in the plan that we'll look at, we assume that after 10 or 12 years, all of the untreated ash trees will be dead. So what you've created is a similar example, where all you have are treated trees. So you have assimilated environment similar to that.
I have another question.
Sure.
How often do you have to treat them? I mean, you're making it sound like one-time treatment is good.
Well, I apologize if that's how I made it sound. The treatments are labeled for 2 years, so absolute guarantee of 2 years. What other cities that have really taken this on in an active way have found is that they can go 3 years because the tree can resist an infestation at a low level without showing any damage. So you rely on those surrounding treated trees. So if you're treating one-third every year, there's always some in the population that are treated. So that's the numbers we're going to look at are going to be assuming one-third of the treated population every year is being treated.
Thank you.
Great questions. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'll shift it back to Jeff, and then I'll be back for more questions. Yeah.
Okay, so now we're going to start digging into the elements of the plan as we're proposing now. And I must say that, you know, since we've been dealing with it since August of 2014, it became evident right away that we had a lot of support from the public to begin treating not only their own trees, but in many cases our trees for us. So we issue permits to contractors to treat public trees if the homeowner wants to take on that expense. And we've asked them to tag those trees with a metal tag so that even if we find signs of EAB in that tree, we know it's being treated, so it's safeguarded, essentially, and we should not have to remove that. And of course, we began our discussions with Rainbow Tree Care and the development of our EAB management plan. So basically, in a nutshell, this plan is designed to extend the time frame that we have to deal with EAB from that 8 to 10 year time frame to a 20 year time frame to make it easier on budgets and to be able to accomplish the work and not fall behind the death curve. One of the main overriding goals of our plan is to retain the benefits that trees are providing. And I think we'll show you that in graphs in a little while. Chemical injections are going to be instrumental in this plan. And I stress chemical injections. There are numerous ways to put chemicals into trees to treat them for EAB, but many of them are wrought with problems, and chemical injections seem to be the most environmentally safe way to use chemicals to battle the insect. We will incorporate stage removals. So what stage removals are a select batch of trees that we're going to decide to treat for a certain period of time in this 20 years. And at some point, when we get through the peak of that death curve, we'll stop the treatment of those trees and we'll begin to remove them as they succumb. And this is how we're deferring some of these costs and spreading it out over a longer period of time. We're going to implement SLAM, okay, through our, you know, closely monitoring and detecting where the infestation is, using integrated pest management techniques, the chemical treatments, in hopes of creating this herd or community immunity. That's the idea that Jeff spoke about, where treating the 20% randomly would give you a greater percentage of trees that will not be infested. And also using trap trees. Trap trees are trees that are girdled. EAB goes after stress trees, so you can actually mimic those stresses by girdling a tree. The idea is that you pull more adults to lay their eggs on that stress tree, and then you remove that tree and destroy the insects before they have a chance for the population to come back out of the tree. So the key action steps for the City of Rochester EAB management plan: we'll continue delimiting surveys, and we'll use that information to guide us in our management activities. Delimiting surveys is just simply going out and looking at trees and trying to figure out where the infestation is advancing to. We'll do that through visual assessment. You can also sample branches from trees and get relatively high accuracy of infested trees that are not showing signs by harvesting a couple of branches off the trees and peeling the bark. And this technique can be as effective as 95% in discovering trees that have it before outward signs are visible. We'll implement pest detection, suppression, and sanitation. So removing any infested trees will be critical, similar to Dutch elm disease. And we'll utilize these trap trees to detect and reduce the populations of those pests. Sanitation of infected trees. Now, one of the things that we plan to do is preserve our structurally sound ash trees. And we know that we have 1,165 ash trees that are in either good or moderate condition. And so these are going to be the trees that we will treat throughout the 20-year period.
So Jeff, just for clarification, that's just boulevard trees we're talking about, not trees in the parks, not private property trees.
Correct. These are public trees.
What percentage of... So these are just ash trees when you say 1165?
Yes.
What percentage of the total population do we think that represents that is under those qualifications you just added?
So we're estimating that we have 12,400 ash trees on public property. 5,800 and some are on boulevards. That's the figure that was on that previous slide. The rest would be in parks, golf courses, and in wooded areas where if they fell, they might impact a trail, a parking lot, or private property.
So even treating all our trees doesn't get us up to the 20% we need?
That's the problem. If you were to treat 20% of the ash trees in this town, I mean, you'd have to include all of the ash trees in wooded areas, yeah. And so, correct.
And we'd be talking 7% a year, something like...
Right. So what our plan is, you know, we have some neighborhoods that are virtually 90% ash trees. We can utilize those techniques to treat trees in these neighborhoods and save the larger canopy. And granted, we may lose some, but that's how we will apply it. So the 1,165 are our good and medium conditioned ash trees. Those will get treated. In addition to that, I would suggest that all ash trees in the downtown campus be treated as well because of their importance and the difficulty in establishing new trees there. So what we're trying to offset is this loss of benefit. And these treated trees are needed for pest suppression. So as the adults fly from infested trees and encounter these, it's going to kill them and reduce pest pressure. We'll also treat trees if for some reason there would be unusually high removal costs. Those would also be candidates for treating a tree. And again, as I mentioned, and we've mentioned, these staged removals are going to, the purpose of them is to flatten out that peak and to draw this out over more years' time. Other municipalities simply get overwhelmed. So the staged removals, the 1,165 trees will be treated every third year for the entire 20 years. There's going to be an additional 1,100 trees that we will treat, and they will be used for stage removals. So they'll get treated in years 4 through 9. Okay, that's the peak period of mortality. And then we'll stop treating those and we'll let them succumb and we'll remove those 1,100 as they die. So that puts those 1,100 removals into the last decade of our 20-year plan. And they will also help in creating this immunity that we've talked about. And granted, we may not be getting 20% of the entire city's ash population, but it will directly benefit in the neighborhoods where we can apply the chemicals. Our goal is going to be to make tree replacements at a 1-to-1 ratio so that we have no net loss of occupied tree sites. Of course, we're going to have to educate and encourage private tree owners to implement action steps that we're outlining in our plan. We would like everyone in the city to follow the same plan, encourage as many private owners to treat their trees as possible to help add and accommodate that 20% or as close to it as possible.
A question here.
Yes.
Jeff, are we going to be doing some public notices, going out through the media sources? Do you have a plan in place?
I wouldn't say I have a formal plan in place at this time, but we will definitely be setting up informational meetings for the public, for contractors that are working with these trees and are administering the chemicals. So we would definitely have an outreach plan, yes.
Make sure you get a hold of our neighbors and get on their speakers bureau list.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Renee and I work very closely together.
Good. We have another question.
Some question. The private property owners will be responsible for treating their own trees at their own cost?
Yes.
And are there any opportunities for people that don't have the money to treat their trees that they could use any of your grant funds? Or what other options are there?
Yeah, typically grant funds are only available for public work, not for private work. Mm-hmm. However, other communities, and I think Jeff can speak to this better than I, have implemented strategies to help subsidize private homeowners to treat their trees because of the multitude of benefits that the whole community gets back from that. And perhaps, Jeff, if you want to answer more to that question now.
Sure, I can. Of course, the city taking action on a scale like this will have some inherent incentivizing for homeowners to follow in line with the plan. In addition, if this work is done through contractors, certainly your contracts to treat municipal trees could have built in a reduced price for homeowners so that you use kind of your bulk buying power to share with those homeowners as well. Other municipalities use actual out-of-pocket funds to create subsidies, or there are adopt-a-tree programs that can be implemented where maybe somebody who is willing to treat an ash tree in their front yard also adopts an ash tree in a different part of town. Or if they want to protect canopy and don't have an ash tree, they could protect ash trees in other parts of town. So there are numerous ways that you can really get people all moving in the same direction, either with municipal funds or without, just using your bulk funding power.
I think that's very important, since you indicated that a large amount of the emerald ash borer infested trees are on private property.
Absolutely.
And so that seems like something you want to look into right away.
Well, and like I said, just taking action as a municipality kind of sanctions the event, sanctions the action for the private property to buy in and see the value in it.
Could I add one more point?
Yes.
My name is Michael Orange, also on the project. And our model shows that as the death curve progresses and all of the untreated ash trees begin to die, by about year 6 or 7, basically, according to the plan, about 20% of the surviving trees will be treated. So you will hit that, not a magic point, but it is, at least the computer models indicate, you will be maximizing herd immunity. So in other words, by the city's actions to treat their trees and protect their trees helps the private sector trees.
We had another question here.
Jeff, what you said 18 inches is the average tree size. Estimated cost per private party to treat one of those be then?
If you were to hire a commercial company to do that, I've heard the figure of $10 per diameter inch, and that's good for 2 years according to the label, and potentially 3 years if you're willing to tolerate the risk in that third year. So $180 spread over 3 years. Now, you know, for part of our plan, and I don't want to get too far ahead, but we're planning to take on the injection of the trees in-house. And at that point, you can reduce the cost per diameter inch to as little as $250 per diameter inch for that same three-year period, minus labor to do it. I mean, that's just chemical cost.
That's a pretty reasonable price.
Yeah, it really is, especially when you weigh it against the benefit side of things.
That was just for municipal trees, correct? Are you suggesting you're offering a service to the community to come out and do
this? No, this is just for public trees, yes.
What would it take to do that? I mean, are we just completely incapable? I mean, would we be...
We'll get to that point.
Okay. I'm excited.
great segue, though.
Sticker shock has come.
So basically, we've laid out three scenarios in addition to the base case. The base case is if we did nothing. If we just allowed it to for our ash trees to die and we attempt to keep up, which every community that's attempted that has not succeeded. They've fallen behind and have resorted in closing parks and doing things to keep people away from the dead trees because they can't keep up. But we're going to compare three scenarios to that base case and lay out budgets accordingly for you to review. So the first plan that we'll compare against the base case is the Ash Tree Preservation Plan A. Okay, ATP is Ash Tree Preservation Plan A. In that plan, low-quality trees would be treated the same as the base case, so they'd be removed and replaced as they die. The medium and high-quality trees, which I indicated before, there's 1,165 of those, would be treated for the entire duration of this 20-year program. The Ash Tree Preservation Plan B. Okay, this is identical to Plan A, except an additional 1,100 low-quality trees that are still structurally sound, but are rated low quality because other native borers have infested them, or they're subject to other conditions that make them less than good or medium quality. But our point is that we would not be retaining trees that have structural issues that could, you know, potentially damage things. So those 1,100 trees would be treated from years 4 through 9, and then we would begin the removal of them in year 10 and remove them through the remainder of the 20-year period of this plan. What this does is it reduces and spreads the peak costs and, most importantly, preserves the benefits that we're getting back from the trees. Of course, some of the treatments are for stage removals, but we are gaining from the benefit that those trees are providing during that time frame. And then the final plan that we want to run by you is the Plan B1, okay? Ash Tree Preservation Plan B1. This is essentially identical to Plan B, except that when the deaths begin of those trees that we were going to stop treating, the stage removal trees, we can decide if we want to retain those and continue treatments. And we have a lot of information that's going to lay out the budgets for these various three plans, but those are essentially the differences between them. And that's just exactly what I covered. So Jeff's going to come back now, and he's going to go through the graphs, the budget information, and we're all available for questions as you have them.
So yes, of course, there is a price. So this is, you know, our attempt to simply show visually the four plants. Base case, now this is in millions of dollars. The base case is the most expensive because removal and replacement is the most expensive option. In addition to the highest cost, it retains the lowest amount of tree value shown by that dotted line. So you spend the most and you keep the less, the least. ATP plan A is much less expensive, you know, relatively. A lot of benefits. You really start to see the tree benefits increase through B and B1 because there are more trees that are treated. Now you have higher total plan costs because in plan B you have shifted those removals to the later years, but still not as high as you do in the base case. And we can show it again in the costs per year, but B1 then has the most trees treated, so therefore the lowest cost and the highest tree value that's preserved. I'm going to move on unless there are questions. We'll show it in a lot of different ways.
So our best deal is $4.5 million.
If you were to take the trees that staff has outlined that are the most desirable for the longest term, yes. Thank you.
Another question.
And that's spread out over the full 20 years?
20 years.
Okay.
Yep. So here's another way to look at it. Base case is in red. Again, you see that death curve peak cost show up in year 6. That's when we assume the greatest number of trees are going to be dying, therefore the highest number of removals and the highest number of replacements, which are the most expensive components of the plan. So we work to flatten that down as much as we can, and you can see in green is ATP plan B. It does bring those annual costs down, but then you see that blip in the later years where those trees that were initially treated start to be removed. Now the dotted line breaks off on ATP plan B. As Jeff said, that is when, you know, staff can decide if these are high enough quality trees to preserve for the rest of the plan outlook. So again, the treatment of the trees, the protection of the trees costs much less than removing and replacing. This is just cost. This isn't taking into account tree value or benefit. We can also look at tree debris. So we know how big all of these trees are. We know when our peak debris management times are going to be. Again, in the base case, we have the biggest spike. We can shift that wall of wood to the later years. Inherent in that tree debris is staff time and storage and management of all those tree removal activities. Then when we compare tree benefits to the base case, remember the base case costs the most and preserves the least amount of benefits. So ATP plan A has significantly more benefits because there are more trees that are protected, and it goes up from there. Again, ATP plan B1 has the most trees protected the longest. So as those trees grow, they provide more benefits each year, and those benefits just start to compound over the 20 years.
So again, to Councilmember Ruska's point, it sounds like B1 has the least cost but the highest benefit.
It does, because it has the most trees treated, the okay. fewest removed.
Another question.
And essentially, if you want B1, you could always shift to B at year 10 and say, we're not going to continue on this course.
So. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep, and that's where you can see this green line. If that is the path you elect, then those removals start to be an issue. But many more years to plan and get ready for that eventuality, and lots of time for things to change. We don't include it in this, but in the years since EAB was discovered in this country, there have been numerous leaps and bounds in the ability to manage it. We can only assume we will have a similar period of time over the next 10 years where things we can't even yet predict might be available to us. So it certainly not only buys us more time, it leaves more options on the table long term.
I think we have a couple more questions.
Oh, sorry, yes.
Mr. Haber, what is, in your estimation, an 18-inch tree, what is the cost to remove it? Any idea?
I'm sorry.
The cost to remove an 18-inch tree?
Cost to remove an 18-inch tree, of course it varies on its location.
Right.
The minute something compounds the removal process, the price goes up. But a typical boulevard tree without any constraints, overhead wires, or things to land on, I would estimate $750, possibly $1,000. And, you know, we get a little bit better rate than private citizen does because we're generally contracted for batches, so that's just based on my experience so far here.
What do you think you get the treatment cost to?
Treatment costs
per inch.
Per inch will be, the cost of the chemical is $250, and I believe in some of Michael's information, the cost for labor is roughly about 57 cents per inch. So $2.07 per inch, roughly, for 2 to 3 years of protection.
Okay. So I just want to follow up. So then basically, if we just do nothing and just remove these trees, it's still a $4.4 million.
If we do nothing and remove and replace, it's $5.2 million.
Because of the replacement tree costs as well.
Okay, all right.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I'm just trying to work through the numbers too. So at the end of 20 years, at $3 per inch, 18 inches per tree, six treatments over the 20 years on estimate, it's about $324 per tree. But we don't know if we're done, right? Like, that's the unforeseen thing here is
right.
We don't know if... The same way that we hope we have the vaccine for emerald ash borer by then, and we can be done with this. We could have super emerald ash borer that eats through trees faster. So if we rip and replace, we don't know if we have a maple borer by then or whatever. So okay,
correct.
Well, I appreciate it.
And if I could, it's likely we will have a maple borer or something else by then. Mm-hmm. I mean, the difficulty in managing stress in even the healthiest trees, just with heat and drought and lack of rainfall, are hard enough right now. So, yes, there's always something on the horizon.
I assume when we replace trees, we replace them with a diversity of species, so we minimize risk.
Absolutely.
For
yes. Okay. That is, if we've learned nothing else from planting American elms too much, now ash, I don't think we'll fall into that trap again.
So then this is just more looks at the, this is cumulative tree value per dollar of cost. So again, we can spend less on the big trees, so the value of that benefit is far better because we have a big tree we spent less on versus the small tree we spent a lot on. But of course, we are talking pesticide treatments. And these are a very appropriate hot-button topic. So I'm going to address it before anybody even brings it up. What about the bees? There is a document put out by the University of Minnesota in conjunction with Michigan State and Ohio State. The Ohio State, I think you're supposed to call it. That feels weird to me, but I have to say it. The Ohio State.
Minnesota.
It's a capital T. There you can see the professors' names that weighed in on this. This was one of the first documents of its kind, and they were the first to really say in plain language, it's highly unlikely that bees would be exposed to any systemic insecticide applied to ash trees. Since then, numerous others have weighed in on this matter because it is such a hot-button topic. From Dan Herms at Ohio State, few published observations of ash pollen in hives is not consistent with direct observations of ash flowers. We've never observed a bee visiting an ash tree. Dr. Deb McCullough from Michigan State does not know of any scientist who believes that treating ash trees with systemic insecticide has any effect whatsoever on pollinators. And from the University of Minnesota, our own Marla Spivak will say, right off the bat, bees do not visit ash trees, and because she is aware of the benefits that trees provide, she believes that the benefits of trunk injected, in this case amimectin benzoate, which is what our plan is promoting, the protection of those trees far outweighs what is considered universally a very minimal risk to bees. So,
quite another question here.
Just got to ask, what about the other critters?
Well, of course, if they are feeding on the trees, they will be killed. There are insects that the entire life cycle depends on the ash tree. However, if we do nothing, the ash tree is extinct anyway. So what we're trying to do is buy more time for all of the other management components to have more time to be implemented, as well as, we mentioned diversity. If you can imagine every municipality in Minnesota looking for 1,000 trees at one time, diversity might be hard to come by in nursery stock. Now, it might not be impossible, but it's going to be difficult. So, yes, we're trying to buy more time.
And I understand that, but I think it's important to lay it out, the fact that we could have issues with other critters that eat up the trees or live in the trees.
Sure.
And there'll be the question, the domestic animals, will they be at risk?
Yeah, that frequently asked questions document addresses that as well. And I can elaborate if you're interested, or I can leave it there.
We can leave it there. I just think it's important that we address it or make the comments.
It's been looked at from numerous universities across the country, and there are many coalitions that have been developed that state very plainly for the treatment of ash trees, the preservation of ash trees is the most environmental and economical option that we have available to us today. Oh, sorry, I jumped ahead.
Yeah,
sorry.
No problem. You know, just a little bit more discussion on that. The reason that we're in favor of using trunk injections, there are other chemicals that can be used to treat for emerald ash borer. However, amimectin benzoate is a non-neonicotoid. Neonicotoids are the family of chemicals that affect pollinators so bad. These other chemicals are in that family. So it is our stance that we do not use those chemicals. There are other inherent problems with groundwater contamination and potential issues like that with using these other chemicals. And so that's the reason we're in favor of limiting only to chemical or trunk injections with amimectin benzoate. So, here in a nutshell is what we would recommend that council. Council would first adopt the City of Rochester EAB Management Plan B. As you stated, we can reevaluate after 10 years. If we choose, if this seems to be working and, everything's stabilized, the front of the insect wave has passed, maybe we decide to continue the chemical injections and implement Plan B1. But they're the same up until that 10-year point. We'd like you to consider increasing forestry staffing levels. For one, we need to meet the disease tree workload that is in front of us. But further, I believe that we need to increase the levels in our department simply to meet our urban forestry management goals. And we'd like to increase our CIP funding to cover the annual expenditures as outlined in the EAB management plan for the next 10 years. And this graph that I'm going to show is how that would play out over the first 10 years. So that, $4.5 to $5 million, this is the anticipated budget for the first 10 years. And then after the second 10 years would be depending on the direction that we go. Either we begin the removal of the stage removals or continue the treatments. The treatments will still be the cheapest option at that point, and we'll still be retaining the maximum benefit from those trees, but that can be revisited at that time.
For clarification, the staffing levels that Jeff talked about in the prior slide, that does not account for EAB removals. That's still going to be contracted out in a very large share. We'll be doing some of that work, but it'll be counted out as well.
The bulk of this plan is predicated on the fact that we'll contract those services if we are expected to maintain the same level of services that we currently provide. The one thing that I'm willing to do in-house, we've already been doing in-house, is the monitoring, the delimiting studies, and also the treatments, because there's such a cost advantage to doing that in-house. We have enough certified pesticide applicators and knowledgeable, skilled people to get that work done. That's one I'm in favor of doing.
Another question. So, Jeff, when you find a disease tree and you take it down, do you destroy it on the site, or are you transporting it? And how are you transporting it to make sure the EAB isn't being spread?
So if we find an infested tree during the flight season, that would be roughly from May 1st until September 1st, and that's based on heat and degree days when the adult flight season occurs. When trees are found during that period, it's recommended to leave them where they're at so that you're not moving it around and you're not creating new outlier sites. When these trees are discovered in the winter, they're removed immediately and destroyed before the adult or the larvae can emerge as adults in the spring. And all of that is done through our city brush dump pathways. We have a commitment with them that they'll deal with this diseased wood. It's kept separate there, and you know, they have big tub grinding services that come in and manage that waste and grind it, which is an acceptable way to render the larvae useless. And then that's utilized for biofuel.
Mr. Camp, is there a question?
Do we have an identification problem at all? I mean, are we adequately identifying and quickly enough identifying the trees that are infected? I mean, I know we're saying it takes time. Are the contractors that are out in the field doing this sort of work regularly, are they receiving the sort of training that lets them do that identification?
At this point, as far as training contractors, there has been no formal training by the city of contractors. They're initially laid out if you want to treat trees, which at that point, you know, we haven't found infested trees really until this year. Now they're really starting to show up more. I mean, 14 trees. But I don't anticipate that number getting much larger because we're pretty much through the southwest quadrant. So the number went from 3 to 14, and from 14 to whatever it is next year. I think we're staying on top of monitoring and finding it, at least on public trees. Private trees are another issue that every community struggles with how to handle that because, you know, there's a lot of ash on private property.
Yeah, I mean, that's my part of my concern here is the, you know, it seems like you guys are relatively certain we don't get anywhere near the 20% with what we're planning to treat, even this plan, the broadest hope. So what can we do beyond, you know, and gosh, I hate to even imagine, the cost of this is astronomical, but it's a very important resource. What can we do beyond that to make sure we're providing the tools for these people that end up visiting these houses anyway? I think I worked at Sargent's Nursery for eight years probably. People that visit there, is there some way we can be doing that research or, you know, making sure we're getting the message to people that are out doing the yard work to say, go look at your trees, these are the signs we look for.
Right.
So I know you say you have a messaging plan.
Yeah, that will be part of an outreach program that we will embark on. As for the population of ash in wooded areas, it's very common that communities are just leaving those untreated and basically fall in place where they are. And those, you know, gaps in the forest will be filled by other young trees and, you know, succession will carry on. But where we can have the effect is on public trees and the private. And so I can't give you any better answers on private right now, only to let you know that that's an impending issue that could become large and be a strain on the wood debris stream, you know, as well as other factors.
I think two things for you, Nick, that you just raised a question on the private side. There are private arborists that do good quality work here in Rochester, and they, I think, have some of the training that is necessary for identification and for chemical application. So I think we rely upon them as well,
okay,
to do some of that activity on the private side. As far as in the trees or in the wooded areas itself, like Jeff just mentioned, we let it drop down. However, there are cases where we want to have those monitored in our parks that are active area by trails and other things like that we need to be very careful of. So it's kind of a twofold approach.
I have one more follow-up here, and I'll try and let some of the other people get some questions in. Are there neighborhoods we've identified that are the ash-rich canopies? And are there suggestions for programs for them specifically that we can target? I mean, is there neighborhoods where our investment's going to pay a bigger bang for its buck if we target those for some sort of, you know, private-public partnership to do some investment? Because, I mean, that interests me a lot if we can get up. I don't know what your 20% number, if that has to be the entire ecosystem or if that can be on a, you know, a smaller scale than the entire ecosystem. We take a neighborhood and we get that up to 20% so we can protect it. What, I mean...
And that is exactly what this plan addresses. We will
okay,
be utilizing
so doing it.
In those neighborhoods, we will be trying to reach that 20% randomly every year.
Even if they're not public trees?
No, this would only be public trees.
I guess that's what I'm getting at. If there are
your question is basically that cost of the, up there would need to go up quite a bit to do private trees.
Yes, this cost is going up quite a bit. I mean, I think we're going to have a lot of very concerned people, because what it looks like is we haven't even started the real wretched part of this, which is people discovering their trees are dead, right?
Right.
And they're going to turn to us and say, what can we do? So I would rather be ahead of this to say, we've looked at these alternatives. You know, if you're really interested, we need a community effort that's going to be 2x what this plan is to be able to go on and do that. That's going to be $500,000 of SIP investment every single year.
I think it's part of the education process that we, as we do go forward, talk to the neighborhoods like Renee and to the community leaders of those different associations about what can you do about this activity. And I think that's part of what we got to deal with. Yeah, we've not developed that yet. Yeah.
And if we can be working, like you said, we have these private people that are qualified to apply these chemicals privately. If we can be working to leverage the city's buying power and working as part of them, that sounds like a win already.
At the very least, that would be a great thing to establish for the residents.
Do we need an agreement to do that, or is that something you'll be bringing forward to figure out how to do that?
Is there future plans we've got to develop yet? Okay. We're on the cusp right now of getting this plan saying, yes, you like idea, you know, B or V1.
Okay.
Okay, we get that plan forward. We can now move it ahead to the next step, which is the engagement process and the CIP.
You brought
process.
It the way I liked it, which is the cheap one's also the best. So I prefer that plan. That's the easy decision for me.
Mr. Bildback.
Mike, question for you. Is this something that we can request or put in the education of those that we support, put out there to tell people that these are tree services authorized by the city?
Yes.
Are we going to use them and make that a part of it, this
yes.
recognition and education piece?
Yeah, I think we're going to end up right now. We've got a tree license or certified list for tree license holders. We'll probably add that to that a listing of EAB management
Perfect.
Certifications. Because right now you could have anybody and their brother or sister come out and say, I can treat your tree, and we want it done the proper way.
Another question. Jeff, you mentioned that this was recognized as a statewide issue. I wonder, what would you guess the options might be of the state providing additional grants or funding to assist communities?
And I will defer to these gentlemen because they are working on exactly that to let you know what work is being done that way.
So in addition to my daily role of helping municipalities, I'm also on the board of the Minnesota Shade Tree Advisory Council. The role of that MNSTAC group is to advise the state of Minnesota on how to manage its forests. We've had a very focused effort at the Capitol to bring this issue forward in the context of even larger trees are really important and have been largely underfunded for a long time. During the days of Dutch elm disease, the state spent millions and millions of dollars to help communities manage elm trees. That influx of state money has really helped preserve a lot of green spaces that we still enjoy today. We feel this is an even bigger issue that will have larger impacts in a shorter amount of time for communities. And we have a bill now introduced into the House, House File 2408, which we are really encouraging people to support. Call your legislator. And we need a companion bill on the Senate side. So we're looking for bipartisan support. That bill would bring $13 million annually in matching grant funds from the state of Minnesota to communities to help manage this pest and the broader community forestry needs in general. We think it's an issue that needs long-term secure funding. The current bill is a two-year budget cycle and wouldn't start until 2017. Now, in 2016, there is a bill introduced into the Senate which might provide some bonding money for municipalities. It's currently only a $5 million cap with the maximum award per city of $1 million. So there is a high likelihood, if it is made available through bonding dollars, that only a handful of cities would pay, small handful. The difficulty with bonding is that it can be used for trees as infrastructure, but it can only be used for removal and replacements, which is a fine bridge in the short term, especially for the city of Rochester, but certainly does not address the long-term tree preservation efforts that are important. So House File 2408 currently is in need of support from everyone.
Who's the sponsor of that bill?
Rick Hansen introduced that bill.
And some have seen this publication going around. This is the publication developed by MNSTAC. It was presented to the Regional Council of Mayors in support of that effort.
Mr. Bilbray?
I think Ms. Mies had a question first, and then let her ask, and then I will next. You have
questions? I did. I just, you know, you mentioned about the public notice or the education of the public that this is underway or being considered. I just anticipate additional calls and inquiries about it if we don't let the public know what's happening, because I suspect the papers and the news will feature this.
Sure. We will make every effort to get this knowledge, you know, out to as many people as we can.
And then you'll see how much it will cost, and then it doesn't include the private property, so, you know, those numbers are pretty staggering.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mr. Bilderman.
Mike, what's the next step? When are we going to see you again for these types of requests? I guess my point is I don't want to leave it end here without having some next spot of getting action done.
So what I'm hearing from you folks right now is that you like Plan B or B1, and we can bring back the formal adoption of this plan to the City Council within 2 weeks, basically. We'll kind of pretty up the document, make it, finalize it, so to speak, bring it back to you with that recommendation. That will give us the tools to start the engagement, the development of the rating plans that we've got to go forward with. And again, you'll see budgetary requests that go along with this in future years.
We need to see it.
So when he mentioned the House File 2408, is that something we should maybe get some follow-up information from staff about to consider adding our resolution of support?
Yep. That's why I wrote it down.
Perfect.
There you go.
So okay. Wants to pass on, you can
we'll
do it.
We'll bring that back forward along with the plan adoption.
Yeah, bring a resolution of support so we can get on that.
It sounds like there's a recommendation for Plan B. There's always the opportunity to consider Plan B1 the 10-year mark. All right. Do we have, refresh my memory, do we have any CIP funding for this?
We do. We have about, it's not specifically for this, it's for diseased trees in general. You may recall a couple years back we used some of that money for storms. But right now I think we've got about $225,000 in that account. We have $50,000 that was put in this year as part of that. Again, next year that will go up. That $50,000 this year will, again, apply our chemical contracts for this year, I think, which is what that will cover.
Okay. Are we in year one, or are we starting year one when you guys finish?
Well, that's kind of
we'll consider
here, Jeff.
This year one.
We're actually probably year two or year three, realistically, from where you find it.
So we're
year one is always considered the year it's found. So.
That, I guess that is what's concerning me is are we in a $350,000 hole or are we ahead $250,000?
Neither yet. I think we're at a point now. If we don't do anything this year, we'll be in trouble. And again, we're planning moving forward with staff initiatives currently.
Okay.
And next year again will be the big ticket item.
Okay.
Okay. Mr. Mayor, this was handed out on your behalf. Yep. Do you have any comments you wanted to share?
Well, I think it was already commented on. This was last week at the Regional Council of Mayors meeting that I was at, and I thought it was timely that they handed this out, and I thought, gee, it's on our agenda here today. So it's being addressed, obviously, all over the state, but the Regional Council is primarily, you know, in the suburbs of Minneapolis-St. Paul, with the one outsider, Rochester, there as well. But that's why I brought it back and I had copies made so that you could all see that too. It is statewide.
Does that conclude your presentation or is there
that concludes the presentation, that is correct.
All right. Other questions?
One other question, just because I may have missed it. You've asked for additional staff and increased dollars in the CIP.
Yes.
And that staff is just for full-time staff. It doesn't have to do anything with contractor expenses.
Correct. But essentially, the staff that I'm referring to is the staff necessary to do the tree work, the street tree work. I feel that we're already behind the curve on our staffing levels. We've began committing staff members to doing the delimiting. We hope to use them to do injections this summer. So essentially, we're already using a staff member to work on this, and that's only complicating our ability to get our other work done. As many of you know, our pruning cycles are not what they should be, and ideally, we would be pruning a tree every 7 or 8 years. In my opinion, I think we're lucky if we get back to that tree every 20 years. So things need to change if we want to be able to elevate our level of service that we're providing the community and to be able to handle this issue that we're on the cusp of.
Mr. Nigber.
Further clarification. The department has put together a staffing report for you folks before last budget cycle. In that report, they provided an arborist in 2017 and 2018. And 2017 one for next year is really the EAB person we're utilizing for staff right now. The 18 person will start building that staff up in the future. So it's not five all at once. We take five at once, but we understand the realities of life.
Mr. Campion, anyone else? Any other questions, comments?
Thank you very much.
You'll be bringing back a proposal?
Yes.
All right.
And I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Moving on to our next item, we have a review of the proposed design for parking ramp number 6. Mr. Freed is going to lead on.
Yes, I'd like to introduce Bill Hickey. Bill is leading the position here to make a presentation. Bill is the architect of the Collaborative Design Group. I am working on the parking ramp design with us. Terry Spaeth and Brent Svenby and Tony Knauer have all been contributing to that. I'd like Terry to maybe just take a few minutes to talk about the relationship that the department has to the Broadway at Center project, because it's going to be part of the presentation and show the joint effort that's taken place so far.
Sure, if I may just take a moment. As the council is well aware, with the Broadway at Center project, it was always contemplated that a ramp was going to be constructed in conjunction with that particular project. And even in the early, renditions of what I'll refer to as a preliminary design of a ramp, the thought was, and how the agreements have been structured is such that the underground level or the basement level of the ramp would be conveyed to Broadway Center for their use. Also, on the ground level of the ramp, particularly on the north portion, the north side closest to Center Street, a good chunk of the first floor will be conveyed to Broadway Center for their use as well as part of their hotel, and then some of the truck docking and some of the other ancillary uses related to that. And then as you go up the ramp, these two projects are tied together essentially because there's direct access at various levels of the ramp right into the Broadway Center Hotel project. So these two structures are, it's like they're married together here. So I guess I just wanted to emphasize the importance here, and we've been working closely with the Broadway at Center development team on this ramp project for, gosh, I don't know how long now, ever since we started with it. So we feel we have a project that we're ready to kind of move ahead with, and Bill will kind of walk through that.
Yeah, the other thing I'd like to mention is that there's a couple of things that we need from you today, if possible. And one is that we're going to present several different options for your consideration, and I like to simplify them as much as I can for you as we go through the presentation. But we have what we call a two-bay option and a three-bay option. The two-bay option has approximately 494 parking spaces. The three-bay has approximately 638 parking spaces. Obviously, they cost a different amount of money. And the other thing that we're going to talk to you about is the potential for an adaptive reuse of this parking land, parking garage for multiple uses. As Terry indicated, the lower levels are already been integrated into the Broadway at Center project as it relates to the lower level parking and some of the street level uses and the connections that as we go up in elevation between the two structures. We're also going to talk to you about another opportunity that you may want to consider for a multi-use, multiple uses of this city property. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Bill. He's going to kind of lead us through some pictures of the some floor plans and some elevation views, and then we'll entertain questions as we go through.
As Richard said, I'm Bill Hickey with Collaborative Design Group.
what we thought we'd do is walk through the ramp as it's evolved from the base two-bay scheme into some of these other options, some really exciting options. One of the things that we've kept in mind, we talk a lot with the Broadway and Center folks, but this is really in the heart of downtown. So there's a larger context here that we keep in mind as we're making these design decisions. The basic scheme is, as Richard mentioned, two bays, meaning two structural bays, two slopes, if you will, in the parking, spanning the full block from East Center to First Street. Essentially the footprint of the existing surface parking lot, entirely west of the rail. In that layout, you can see the rail line coming across the bottom of the screen. The main ramp service works off the bay furthest from the Broadway Center development, and the purple areas are the occupied by the hotel areas, a service lane coming through, and then an operations office.
If we could just back up for a second. Yeah. So this is where we started.
Yes.
And we started with the concept of that the alley was being vacated from this point north, and that there was, in essence, a new service drive or alley that came through the ramp. So basically you could go from Center to First, whereas before you came through the alley here, we basically connected these two buildings, if you will, and there was expanded hotel purposes here, and this became the alley. So that's, again, kind of the first concept. Mm-hmm. And again, as we continue to talk and work collaboratively with the Broadway Center, we've evolved now to what you'll see in the next slide.
Right. And an additional consideration is the existing Broadway residences operate their garage and their service dock off of that existing alley. So as Richard mentioned, the evolution of this has reversed the thinking a bit in that now the lower level hotel access would be immediately adjacent to the hotel space off of Center Street. There would be additional space available for hotel use, and that service alley is reconfigured to be, rather than the through alley, a more of a service court arrangement. Gives us an opportunity for more occupied space on Center Street, and gives a better access to the loading areas there. In this case, the public access now is from First Street up. Because of that need to have that service court, service alley, we essentially have to have a double height first level from what a traditional parking ramp would be. If you think of the height to get a semi-truck through, we have to maintain a pretty hefty clear height as we come through. So we have a speed ramp up and then into parking level. The lower level, though, is very straightforward. This is just a conventional ramp area for the hotel parking. So the second level, again, the two bays come up, and we have, as Richard mentioned, we have the direct connections into the new Broadway Center project. We're also able to look at an option for a Skyway connection to the Broadway residences adjacent to where the existing Skyway crosses First Street and connects there. So we fully knit this structure into the Skyway system.
Another thing, Bill briefly touched on it, but we maintain this full width alley here, this full 18 feet for access to the Broadway residence. We had actually initially started again with the ramp coming and bisecting the alley and only leaving 9 feet. That was not acceptable to the current owner of this property. So we backed that off. The full 18-foot alley up to this distance is still there. But you can see what happens as we go through these floor plans. All of these parking stalls are lost along that face. If this was extended here, we'd have that full width of parking that you see here all the way through. But we've lost that for almost half of that far west side of all of the decks as we go up.
Not even some parallel spots?
It gets really tight in there, and it's possible, but it gets really, really tight.
For a compact car? parking, things of
that nature. Narrow cars, maybe?
No, here.
Smart cars.
As we go up, then, it becomes what you more typically experience in a parking facility, except for the notch that Richard mentioned. Very straightforward parking, 90-degree parking, stair towers, elevator, connection still on a couple levels now to Broadway at Center Project to serve their event traffic and better knit the buildings together again. We do, looking at this, we always look at what happens if we need to expand. In some of the later drawings you'll see also, but being next to these two tall towers, we have some adjacency issues where some of their mechanical services, louvers, exhausts, and intakes for air come out that we have to stay under. So we're constrained on height. So that means we're looking at options for lateral expansion. In this case, we're looking at could we bridge coming across to the east. Massing-wise, the two-bay scheme looks about like this. It does line up with some of the features on the hotel. You'll see some of the green wall and things. With the railroad track, we have some constraints in terms of construction ability next to it, and ability to get cranes in, some pretty simple stuff. So we're looking at, in this case, a pretty lightweight metal pattern sort of facade coming through. This is the view from first. As we went through all this, it became really apparent that there was an opportunity here to both increase our parking number and really leverage this development to the benefit of the broader context I mentioned. Looking at spanning the tracks as a means to add a third bay. This is what that looks like initially. The hotel spaces stay the same, the parking access stays the same. On ground level, because of the need obviously to keep the trains running, we span the tracks, but it is a bridged situation. The deck is over the tracks at the third level. Day one, we'd have an opportunity to just keep the existing angle parking that exists on First Avenue today along there. What's exciting about this is long term. Richard mentioned some of the possibilities as we go. Here's a couple of different looks. That space over on First Avenue could be a great covered space for food trucks or electric bus charging. We would also, it also works out size-wise, it's a great location and size for a light rail station. If a trolley or rail circulator ever happens, it's inherent in what's built there. None of this has to be built today, but that potential will be there. There'll also be an opportunity to put some small-scale retail along First as well, really animate all the sides of the building. The trains are taller than semis, so on the second level there's only two bays because we need to keep that high space for the trains coming through. Otherwise, again, it functions very much as a traditional facility. Come up to the third level, we've got three bays of parking, the outer and side toward Broadway Residence, and Broadway at Center are flat bays, the slope of the bay is in the middle. And that, again, just continues up. In this case, again, to that limit, that constraint from the mechanical system and the adjoining buildings. This is how that concept passes out. You can see the accommodation for the train or what have you coming through, and it's a broader mass, and it steps away from the tall tower, but it does relate still in some of the details in materials.
And as Bill pointed out, it's this space here on the First Avenue face of the structure at the ground level that has these opportunities. We initially can start with just keeping the angle parking, or you could do some other things that might relate to, again, we've talked about the possibility if we went to electric buses, we'll need to charge them someplace having a charging station. Not decided we do it, would do it here, but it could be something. We could maybe have enough space where they would pull in this space and use it for bus charging. Or we just, a little lightheartedly, but said, well, it'd be a good place maybe to have food trucks show up and landscape this space and everything and have a covered space in the middle of the summer where basically people could congregate. It needs to be an active space. We don't want it to be just a cavern under there where three trains a day maybe go through, or three trains a week, I'm sorry.
Richard, and there's no easement or issues related to the railroad?
We bought those now. You have purchased those rights to basically use the facility like this. Okay. So we now have this ability by us acquiring those rights.
And I understand that part, but during construction and so forth, what would be the...
There'd have to be accommodations. But even with a two-bay, you're building it right up to the railroad right-of-way on the west side.
Right.
So again, the earth stabilization systems that you need and everything are inherent, in, at least partly, in the two-bay. They'd be more expensive in this portion, but again, there's going to have to be some accommodations. And we obviously have to work with the railroad because as part of the purchase agreement, they still have an easement across the property to use it. So we still have to work through those, but there is... opportunities. There's a lot of challenges on this project so far, but we're trying to show you there are some opportunities also.
Okay. I think Ms. Means has a question.
Would you just elaborate a little bit on earth stabilization?
Okay. So what we need to be able to do is build up to the railroad tracks as close to possible as we can. And what there's two ways then when you dig a hole next to something, you can either lay the slope back so that the soil doesn't fall in on you, or basically you put an earth retention system in and you hold that soil in place while you're excavating to put your footings and your foundations in. And I mean, one option is to remove the railroad tracks for a short period of time, get our construction done, and then put them back. That probably isn't going to be acceptable. We're going to have to find some middle ground on how to go about doing that.
Thank you.
We are still looking at materials and different options, and obviously the design does continue to evolve. An example of a neutral palette, again, same mass, same design, just some different features as we go.
So pointing out some of the architectural things. Sure. So we tried to, again, working with the Broadway at Center project, maintain a similar architectural treatment across here using similar materials below this canopy level line, again trying to replicate some of the vertical features. So again, we've been working with them and there was some interest in again trying to have this look like it was designed in such that it worked together. It wasn't two totally separate things that were just joined at the hip.
Right. Again, another look at that. As Richard says, to be a good neighbor. And one of the other advantages, again, thinking of that broader context, is this leap across the tracks, if you will, allows us to put stair and elevator service on that side closest to the Civic Center, where we think we'll have a lot of event parkers, pedestrians coming in back and forth to the facility. Thinking way down the road, this, as I mentioned, is absolutely the heart of downtown and is a great spot for housing. We took a look at, is it feasible to put multi-floors, multi-family housing on top of this facility, using some of the capacity, adding a little bit, augmenting it, but then bringing it up. And it is indeed possible to do, obviously, structurally, and from some of the conversations, there's interest in some of the development world that housing development here might be beneficial.
We've reached out to some developers and asked them. Initially, we were talking about maybe four floors of 10 units each. They said really to make something like this work in the private sector world, and that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about the city building this residential tower, but basically providing the footings and the foundations and the structure up to that point and then basically having that as something you could sell or market or however you wanted to convey that to somebody in the future to develop. The response we got is that you really need to be probably about 100 units here. So we're showing 10 levels, 10 floors of 10 units each.
There'd be an opportunity for green roof, a number of different really interesting opportunities come out of that. And it's fairly graceful with the tall towers on the block. The 100 units fits in pretty comfortably. These are some of the more technical drawings, just showing you the relationship of the size of the building to the Broadway at Center building. This is Broadway at Center up to this point, and then the parking facility from the edge over. This is the railroad frontage, the two-bay scheme I mentioned, the idea of the lightweight metal that could be used as a green wall, things that would really kind of liven up that frontage. And now this is Broadway Residences to the left there. And then by comparison, the three-bay scheme, you can see now we've extended past the track. But again, we keep those horizontal lines. We'd still try to be a good neighbor to the buildings. Coming around, this would be the First Avenue frontage now, and then First Street.
So one thing that the three-bay gives you more parking. It gives you an active street front on First Avenue versus kind of that blank wall that you would have under the two-bay that would be west of the railroad tracks. The railroad tracks are always exposed, always visible there, always what do we do with that space type of issue. So again, it provides some opportunities. And so the difference, you know, cost between a two and a three-bay we'll talk about here in a minute. But what we're indicating, if the cost to provide that opportunity for that a residential tower or an office tower, whatever it may be, there's a cost to that in the initial phase of the footings and the foundations and the columns going up. And that cost, I think we've ballparked it, if you will, somewhere in that range at $750,000 or so to reinforce this first phase, if you will, this three-bay concept, because it only applies to the three-bay. The residential tower sits above that third bay, if you will, and that would, in essence, be the width of it.
Mr. Bildebeck?
I like this look. I like the fact that it doesn't look like a parking ramp, and I like the idea that you've gone out of the norm of what we've done and out of the box to be thinking about how we could activate the street levels. Are we going to, at this point, are we going to make sure that we put the trees, the 35-foot trees, and get them back in? What are we doing with the trees along the outside of this?
We haven't really got to streetscape or anything yet.
No, that's fine.
We obviously have some standards that we apply to other development downtown, and obviously we're going to be looking at that same thing. We're trying to, again, make it. We tried to activate as much as the frontage we can. I mean, you need to get in the ramp. The train has to go pass through. Again, being able to create an active First Avenue side to this, you know, in addition to the additional parking you get. But we tried to look at all of those things.
Yeah. I like what you've done, Richard, and the group that has designed this. I like the fact it doesn't look like a parking ramp, and it looks like a neat building with some neat architectural pieces to it. And I'm glad that you looked at going up. I think the fact of having the ability to do that at that cost is really a good idea.
Yeah. And as Bill pointed out, we do have some constraints here as it relates to how high we can go. Usually that's dictated by your exiting and how many cars you can get through on exiting. Really, it's dictated here more by our neighbors to the west. And again, some of the mechanical systems, particularly the ventilation and fresh air makeup systems that exist there, and also the level of where the rooms begin. I mean, we've all stayed in hotels in big cities where you look out and there's somebody literally, you know, 18 feet across the alley, another building, and it doesn't create quite the view. So I've passed out this spreadsheet basically to try to put this a little bit into perspective here, and we're still struggling again at the conceptual stage here. These are very preliminary estimates as it relates to cost. But what I did in the first three columns is I looked at the First Street ramp. You're all familiar with that. Pretty traditional, you know, counterclockwise up type movement, angle parking, perpendicular parking is a lot more efficient if you can accommodate it. We looked at the Third Street ramp, the original design of the Third Street ramp that was centered between Third Street and Fourth Street. And then we looked at the 3rd Street expansion, which again, if you think about this project a little bit, we were bridging over 3rd Street and building another section of elevated parking. And so we kind of looked at the 3rd Street expansion as kind of similar to the 3-bay expansion. So what I've done is I've kind of looked at, again, I've got information about the number of spaces, the elevator towers, the leasable space, all of that in here. But really it comes down to, again, what is the cost running here? So we've got a construction cost estimate, very preliminary. We're basically probably a 50% design right now, if that. So again, it's very preliminary. But what we're looking at on this cost per space, because that's kind of what people look at parking ramps, it's kind of the parameter that's used a lot. And so in the First Street ramp and the Third Street ramp original, adjusted for inflation, and went back and looked at the actual construction cost, adjusted by our ENR that we use on all of our other things. We're basically in that $22,000 range for First Street ramp. The Third Street ramp was a little cheaper at about $20,000 per space. And again, comparing the blue column, which is the original thing, we're at basically $33,000 for the 2-bay. Now, why are we so expensive? Well, if we go back and we look at the, I'm going to have Bill go back to the early slides. If we look at all the purple, and the mustard color here, these are spaces that we can't use for parking. They're being used for something else. And then we add to that the dark gray here. We would normally have a whole half bay of parking here, another 40 parking stalls at this level. As we go up a level, I pointed out the fact that we're losing a quarter of the parking in this one bay because of the alley issue here. So we have a lot of, don't want to use the word inefficiencies, but I don't have a better word for that. In this construction of the Second Street ramp, we don't have any parking below that's public parking. It's all private. Again, it's all part of the negotiations that have taken place with Broadway Center. So it's hard for me to sit here and tell you that you know, is I can't build that 2-bay ramp for the same that we build other 2-bay ramps. There's just a lot of other things. We don't have something similar like this in the First Street ramp or the Third Street ramp. We basically just have a traditional parking ramp that we built. It's 120 feet wide and 300 feet long. We don't have that here with the Broadway at Center project and how we've attempted to, again, integrate some of the leasable space and other things there. But what I can say is the expansion, the two columns that are highlighted with yellow here, is the Third Street expansion cost us about $25,000 of space, and we're looking at about $28,000 here for this particular one. So I can't sit here and tell you that we're building this. What we're building west of the railroad track, I can't compare it to anything else that we've ever done and show you that a cost is going to be comparable. But the bridging over and the addition and the efficiencies and the extra capacity we get, the additional 144 spaces for the 3-bay, and then some of the other opportunities that it brings is something that, again, this is about the best way I can try to compare and give you an apples-to-apples comparison of something that we've done in the past.
And I appreciate that, but I agree with you. We should find some way to factor that in. So, for example, at Third Street expansion, there's no opportunity for additional parking, whereas you are providing some opportunities.
Yes.
With this ramp. Plus the whole component or residential component. I mean, there's value there in terms of the massing and density. And
there seems to be from, again, we've just talked to a few people, but they said, why wouldn't you at least consider that? You can decide not to, but once you build the structure, you're pretty well set for the next 75 years of what it's going to entail. this has to be, the proper term is a high-rise construction, but the residential tower on top will have to be precast. It can't be stick construction. Right. And some of the other proposals in the past that you've heard where people have wanted to build residential workforce housing on top of parking ramps, you can't build stick higher than 75 feet in the air. Mm-hmm. So you can go up two or three levels, and you could put two or three levels, maybe a stick construction on top, but that's all you could do. You can't go this high with stick construction, and so that's the difference here. This won't be affordable housing. It won't be workforce housing. It would be high-end residential housing. And is there a market for that? Only time will tell. But by providing that opportunity, it may be 3 years from now, it may be 10 years from now, it may be 15 years from now, but somebody will find this, potentially will find this to be cost-effective. And so do you make that investment of $750,000 now to see some benefit in the future.
And it would be good to make this public knowledge and have some of those discussions earlier rather than later, even if you did nothing more than shell space or something of that nature.
Right.
Mr. Campion.
So on the DMC plan, this is shown as kind of greenway trail area. Are there elements of that plan that are going to be brought into some of this ground level work that's being done here? Because it kind of just... looking at the plan, this bisects, you know, what would be the middle of that functionally.
It's not intended to go against the plan, but I think, to be fair, it's not consistent with the plan. This is not shown as a transportation corridor here. It's shown as the cultural crescent. They were showing water flowing along the railroad tracks here. It was a concept. It was a vision. There's been a vision to do something as it might relate to streetcar or light rail along this corridor for the last 15 years. So, again, it's a concept. Yeah. If the rail goes away, you can still have a lazy little stream going through there instead of the rail, but it's an opportunity to take advantage of what we know today. I don't think it precludes
the next slide. The one that shows the options on first down one. Sorry, giving you a hard time. So it looks like there would be an opportunity, you know, depending on how this bottom is structured, at least to integrate some of the transit opportunities for, you know, these bike highways or whatever we want to call them, where you get people around town that way.
Sure. Very much.
One of the blessings of having a plan is having a plan to some degree, and I know we all call it a framework or whatever, but I look at this and I say it's aspirational. You know, if we want to have a bikeway and we don't work to put the pieces together to do it, we will never get it. So I saw this, it's intriguing, I like that the ground level is activated, it was awesome that you put food trucks on it, but I would like to see something that integrates a little bit more with this idea of how do we bring this kind of other transit mechanism in here. And I think the light rail is great. I don't have light rail train to put in there yet, but hopefully someday maybe we get something like that.
But it could be a streetcar that goes and serves a facility that's located at the fairgrounds, for example.
So you're telling me you got that in the works, right?
I'm telling you,
it's just giving you a hard time, but
no, I think it's why not? Why not?
Well, why not is it's really expensive. So I mean, like, that's the why not. As I look here and I go, yes, we're spanning this. Are we gonna build? You know, I assume when we start spanning it, we've kind of got to understand what we're gonna have underneath it. We got to commit to having the train entrance at that point.
It has to be something other than a tunnel that the train goes through. Right. We fully acknowledge that, and it's conceptually we want to make it an active space. What that means right now, I can't give you more than maybe the couple examples that we've shown here. But the other thing that, you know, we're trying to do, you know, we've got bike parking, we've got bike lockers, we've talked about that. We basically are talking about plug-in capabilities for electric cars. We're talking about basically having cars that people can rent here. So basically as we do our modal shift, the people who need to basically who come in on the bus to downtown during the day can go and rent a car here to run an errand that they have. So, I mean, we're looking at this being a multimodal station, if you will.
My point is to echo Mark's sentiment that it's awesome to see some less traditional thinking about what the park and ramp looks like. I'm excited about the prospects of spanning, but I'd also really like to see some way to integrate the broader DMC, you know, this crescent idea in this plan. Maybe we move the crescent slightly off the train track to make it work here. You guys are amazing with the skills you have here on these drawings. We can figure out something, but I would like to see that integrated a little bit more wholeheartedly here, because I feel like if we don't do it, sends a little bit of a message to everyone else along the crescent that this just isn't going to happen.
And we've been running out of challenges, so thank you for that.
Oh, if only my title was make everyone else's job easy.
So again, it's where we kind of are in this process, and is two bay or three, and basically, do we start designing for the structure to accommodate some further elevation of it upward, and whether it's office space, whether it's residential, whether it's a combination, do we start incorporating that into the designs as it relates to the footings, the foundations, and the structure itself?
Is there anyone that believes we should not entertain the three bay and the possibility of those options?
Can you tell me a little bit about the conversations you've had about with the you said you talked with a few interested parties.
I talked to the gentleman from who's developing across the kitty corner across the street over here.
Stencil.
Yep, and he actually is very, he's the one that gave us the advice. Nothing less than 100 units to make this work. He says, when you're ready to do something and make a decision, let me know. So I mean,
it would be so much better if he would come on board ready to do a project.
And we've been trying to get here for, this is our third attempt to get before you, okay. And it just hasn't worked out in his schedule to be here. But if that's the direction you want to go, it's not going to take long for the word to get out. And again, I don't know when it might happen, if it ever does happen, but the mere fact that just seeing something like this, he said, give me a call when you're ready.
Well, I was going to say, if the council was so inclined to include that into the design of the ramp, I mean, I guess I would just suggest that, you know, as we get further down the line and get construction underway on a couple of these other projects, get them going, my thought is we would do an RFP for that. The incentive to a developer would be, as Richard indicated, we've already put in the support, the foundation support to accommodate that. Potentially you could either sell or provide an incentive, you know, for the air rights or whatever, cut out that, convey that space to somebody to build in, and then there are some opportunities for a little bit of parking in that to go along with those units. To me, that's all the city would have to provide is any kind of incentive. Everything else would be up to the developer to deal with, although as Richard said, this isn't going to be, you know, typically going to be workforce or affordable housing. These are going to be higher end market rate units that would be.
And so we're all on the same page that we're being reimbursed the $750,000 to build this thing to spec, or is this a giveaway?
That's going to be up to you. That's going to be up to the RFP process, and that's why, you know, people will come forward and say, this is what.
Was the developer interested before or after we said we'd like to have the $750,000?
Well, they'd have to build it.
Both.
I'm sure they would like to give it to them.
Mr. Ruska.
Richard, has the Broadway at Center developer been involved in this? You said they've been involved in this process and they're okay with it.
They're here. They've attended probably half of our design meetings, sat in this very room and worked out issues related to access, and the floors don't line up, so there's basically the elevators in the northwest corner here basically have to stop at mid-floors, kind of like the second street ramp does now. So I think we worked through a lot of those issues, but Gus or Hal or Brian, do you have any, I mean, they haven't told us they don't like what we're doing.
Yeah.
Well, I have to believe, based on the fact that we're trying to finalize some agreements with them related to this, that they're on board with it.
Yep, they've seen it. They've had the latest copies of everything we've
done. It's a little different to be having housing right across than it was before. So.
Yeah.
And a follow-up to that discussion is that we are attempting to close the deal with Broadway Center, and they need some assurance that the public's going to build this ramp in terms of that closing. So in addition to the decision of whether or not you do the three-bay or the two-bay, and whether or not you do the $750,000 for the potential to allow some housing in the future, you need to provide some insurance that you're going to build this ramp.
In what form? What does that insurance need to be?
Brian or Gus, do you know what form? You need a letter?
Say that again.
That's probably what form of assurance do you need from the public that you're going to build the ramp? That we're going to build the ramp, the city's going to build the ramp.
Part of the unity agreement.
I'm sorry?
It's part of the unity agreement, right? Terry?
I apologize. I have another conversation.
The assurance that we're looking for on the ramp being built is part of the unity agreement.
Part of the development assistance agreement.
Agreement, yes.
Between city of city's EDA and, well, and actually, quite frankly, I mean, the language is already in there and was approved by the council. We're just revamping agreements to kind of bring it up to speed with the changes over the course of time with the Broadway Center's project and the city's ramp project as they've evolved. So we're not changing the tenets of any agreement or anything like that. We're just revamping how they're put together, essentially.
In the preliminary development agreement, you agreed to build the parking ramp adjacent to it. You just haven't ever looked at the design.
Even beyond the preliminary, the actual development agreement that we're kind of reworking now, which was approved last April by the council.
Yeah, and I'm just sensing that there's still some gap here, that they're looking for something, and I'm hearing that we've sort of addressed it. I'm just trying to get to whatever action is required on our part, or, you know.
Well, first, I guess the question would be whether or not you want the two bay or the three bay.
Yeah.
And whether or not you want to do the $750,000 to allow the potential for future housing.
Mr. Hickey?
Yeah, so that's my question. What's the timeline on that decision? So it's two bay, three bay, and do we want to put the structural support for the housing? So what's the timeline on that decision?
Well, ideally, we get some idea of your, I mean, original feelings on that.
Based on our... Maybe 5 minute look at this.
I don't think there's anything associated with the three bay that adversely affects Broadway at Center. Their parking is below the two bay. It's below the two bay in both options. The connections to their building is in the two bay and the three bay. So I think one thing they're asking for is if it changes, the part that affects them changes. That's the assurance they want, is there won't be any changes to the parts that affect them. So that they enter off of Center, they go down into their garage, they've got 91 spaces below the gate, their gate. That they've got these connections at these various elevations. Those sorts of things is the assurance they're looking for. From the perspective of the two bay versus the three and the ability to go up, we're at a schedule right now that the agreement requires this ramp to be complete the day they open the doors. Right now, your schedule is to open the doors January of 2018, which means we have to start this project this fall. And so we're about 50% done with design. So as much as we'd like to get that direction today, I would say we probably have 60 days yet that puts more and more pressure on the architect to get the drawings done and everything, maybe less uncertainty. But I think the two versus three and the reinforced foundation, probably 60 days would be the max.
So I would ask again, is there anything that people would dissent from pursuing or looking at the three-bay option and as well as the additional structural?
So say, I mean, continue to look as opposed to a final decision.
Right.
Well, sure. I mean, I think that's what we're doing right now.
Right.
Considering all options.
Right.
Yeah,
I think I'd like to broadcast that we're interested in proposals people are going to come back with to go on top of this ramp. Because I feel until we get some sort of solid thing, investing almost $1 million worth of the city, you know, the public's money into it with the hope that there's some future payoff is pretty,
yep.
I mean, that puts a pretty high onus on us to come back and show we've done some work. So I'd like to feel like, okay, here are the interested parties. I mean, even better, if they're so interested that we can sign them up before we invest the $750,000.
Yeah, it would be nice if it were more.
But from Bill's perspective, he has to design something that's going to go to basically a set of final plans that we can get a cost estimate on, that we can go to secure a contractor with, and we could actually prepare two sets, one with the reinforced foundations and column. I mean, we could prepare a bid alternate, if you will. So if that's a concern, because it's going to take 6 months to probably go through an RFP process. It'll be about the same time that we're probably ready to bid and award, but it's not something we're going to get people signing up in the next, you know, 2 weeks.
Well, in terms of potential redesign, tonight you're already going to be asked to increase the redesign process by $336,000. And so at some point in time, hopefully, that redesign would stop and those costs of redesigning would stop. We've also had some situations where we worked on this unity agreement for over a year and finally are getting close, hopefully, because that unity agreement with the Broadway Plaza building was very important to how that Broadway Center project gets built and also how the parking ramp got built. And then we have another thing we've been mucking around with, the transformers to serve this project has been something that's been going on for a number of months, and even as end of today, I don't think we're in any really strong conclusion of where that's placed, but the 2-bay and the 3-bay design will also affect where that transformer goes. And so the sooner we know what your general feelings are, the better off we'll be.
One thing I failed to point out as we're going through, there is a Skyway connection here in the southwest corner to the Broadway Plaza project and the Skyway that currently comes across First Street. So we are making this connection here. And I just want to let you in. There's an
and that connection was very important to get that unity agreement. We wouldn't have got it with Broadway Plaza without that.
Well, I think you're hearing that there is consensus to at least explore that 3-bay option. Ms. Mean, go ahead.
Well, the reason I think this is a great idea just to prepare for the future and have that space activated adjacent to the train and to have the structure in place so that if we do get a developer that's interested in building high-end housing on the top, that the structure would be there and ready to accommodate that.
Quick comment, if I could.
Go ahead.
Just a couple comments. And first of all, I want to thank the city staff. They've done a tremendous job working with all of us to create some very complicated agreements for this project. So I really want to commend the staff for all the hard work and effort that they've been able to work out with us. But secondly, the 394 two-bay option stalls is actually slightly under what our expectations were as we progressed.
494.
494? Oh, that's 494. Yeah. I'm sorry. Okay. So the 494, almost 500, I guess.
Yep.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood. I thought you said 394 on the
Okay. So some consensus to pursue, keep pursuing a 3-bay, but whether or not you put on, you beef up the foundations, you still like to get a little feedback on prospective developers that might be interested in that?
So, I mean, I think there's, I mean, it doesn't have to be decided right now. I mean, if we've got time, I don't think it's going to take 60 days, but, I mean, I've only heard the same detail for 45 minutes. Just, I think it all sounds promising, but just some.
Can we proceed though with the 3-bay design at this point in time?
I would say we don't shut down any.
Isn't that what we're voting on tonight on D20? Is that $340,000?
Well, that's just cost to date.
Well, so we're approving cost to date after it's been spent?
No.
Is that correct?
No, that's an amendment
to finish it.
To finish it off. The assumption is a 3-bay, and the assumption is that it's the reinforcing of the footings and foundations.
So, in essence, we vote on this tonight, we're supporting the 3-bay process.
Well, you're providing enough budget to do that, but if you were to tell us in a month or 2 months that you don't want that, we would just not finish that portion of it. I think the 2 and 3 is really critical right now. The additional foundation support is something that you probably can put off for 60 days to finalize that.
And I think we're saying we're interested in the 3-bay, but we want to reserve final decision until we get some additional input and so forth.
Sure.
And it sounds like that could certainly happen within the 30 to 60 day time frame.
I'll work with Bill to go as slow as we can for the next 60 days.
No, I don't think it's going to take that.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so either.
I think when you have it done, bring it back. If it's prior to that, fine.
Well, I don't want to spend the money needlessly. And I think that's Stephen's point is that if there's still some uncertainty yet, we've got a little bit of float in the schedule right now. It's from the design perspective. But if we don't get started with a final design in 60 days, we could be in trouble as far as delivering on our commitment.
I do think if you're going to invest the money in this area, you'd be better off getting the additional parking spaces. that the three-bay design allows you to do.
They're the cheapest ones you're going to build. That was what I was trying to point out in the spreadsheet.
The time frames we're talking about and so forth, how does that dovetail with Mr. Campion's comments about how well this meshes with whatever the DMC vision might be for that area?
I think we could spend some time on that in the next 30 to 60 days to see
that. That Crescent design, though, is about $430 million of public money. And, I mean, it looks nice on paper, but to actually bring that about would be something quite difficult.
Mr. Campion?
It's a good thing that we're all about making their lives difficult, right? I mean, I think that was part of it, is like none of the DMC stuff is necessarily easy. I get it's $430 million. I get we might end up well short of that in the investment, but the idea is a transit corridor that allows more pedestrian access. That's all. That's what I'm really asking about.
You got to replace the library at some other location.
Oh, well, yeah. Maybe we can build the Crescent through it. We'll figure out how to do it. But my other side was, I was going to ask, for me, it's about starting the conversation a little bit. Like, I imagine I'm going to leave this today. It's going to get in the paper. I'm going to have a whole bunch of conversations with community that are going to help me form a great opinion about this project. That process probably takes me about the next COW meeting, maybe one more COW meeting to come back and have just a follow-up on this.
Sure.
Is that a timeline that everyone will feel comfortable kind of bringing us to a conclusion by then?
Well, that'd be my recommendation. Probably on the 14th, so.
Perfect. Sounds perfect to me.
The what? Next COW is probably the 14th, right?
29th?
22nd. Yeah, because we're not having, well, yeah. We're not meeting on the 7th, so the 14th is your next opportunity.
So then how are we leaving the subject? Bring it back. No decision at this point. We'll bring it back on another COW meeting.
Well, there's no final decision. We're certainly, and I'll tell me if I got this wrong. We're certainly receptive to the idea of the three-bay concept, with the possibility for reinforced structure that would potentially allow for a residential structure above. Sounds like Richard is going to have some conversations with some DMC individuals to see how well this plan meshes with the overall vision. Beyond that, what else are we looking to bring back? We'd love to get some at least preliminary feedback from the development community that there would be more than passing interest in something like this that would help us decide whether the investment of $750,000 is worth it. Is that what we're asking?
Yeah.
And
did a good job.
On the committee of the whole meeting on the 14th, come back and have some additional discussion.
Okay.
Does that give you enough, Steve, to...
Do you want it on the 14th, or do you want an earlier one than that?
14th is as soon as I can be ready.
I think the 29th would
get the library plans at that date, and then we're going to talk about the police precinct and some other things, too, so it'll be an interesting meeting.
They're all interesting.
They're all interesting.
But
so
they got
queued up a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
So you're going to get the Crescent through the library.
Well, I don't know if that's good. You just wait then on any further development.
We'll work on this Crescent
thing.
We'll
talk to Richard. Yeah. Right, I think that's something that we can act on in the streetscape questions that have come up. We're largely on hold in terms of the structural design and the mass of the building, if that makes sense. So we'll just hold on that and work on these other items.
Yeah, I don't. We are presenting in front of Q tomorrow, so I don't expect there'll be any other requests after that meeting. So
no, bring it back. Bring it back here.
I will. Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like we've got a little runway to work with.
Okay.
You know,
got
60
it.
Days.
Let's
so
use it.
Let's do it.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. It's very intriguing. All right, anything else for this evening, or this afternoon? Then we will adjourn and see everyone this evening.